This double issue of Audio Arts starts in the British Pavilion at the 2001 Venice Biennale, where the soundtrack of Allegri's Miserere is heard as part of Mark Wallinger's projected video installation, Threshold to a Kingdom. For BBC News, but I'm very interested because we spoke very briefly the other day, and this is the first Venice Biennale you've been to, and this year it's absolutely extraordinary as a phenomena manifestation. I just wondered what your initial reaction to the whole thing has been.
I think my initial reaction, and I suppose this may sound a bit parochial, but I'll try not to be, is how fantastically British art is standing in the Biennale. And there is this idea that work springs from Britain, and immediately an international jury will look at it and assess it. Now, this can have great failings and it can be very frightening, but it's very interesting that Mike Nelson's piece out in the Giudecca, you know, he's a Turner Prize candidate. Turner Prize really matters across the world, and that is huge pressure for some of the artists, and I think some of them find it very tough. But nevertheless, their work is out here. It's of significant importance. It's of sufficient stature to be taken very seriously by the world. And I would warrant that more international journalists would go to the British Pavilion and look at what's going on there than, say, the American Pavilion, which is great, really, if you think about it. And I think that Mark Wallinger's display at the British Pavilion is slick, it's moving. It's quite difficult to be slick and moving, because oftentimes they're in opposition. It's witty. It's thought-provoking. It is truly international. It is easily understandable. It's also subtle and complex. And I think it's a fantastic testament to the real staying power of British contemporary art. A lot of people thought the sort of what one might lazily call the sensation generation would be a flash in the pan. Mark had a piece at Sensation. The same piece is on show here, the Angel film, supplemented by a lot of new pieces. But I think that, you know, it's shown that it's got legs and it's got real stature and position.
I mean, what is interesting, over a period of not very many years, 4 or 5 years, contemporary visual art has become foregrounded in a way that it didn't, in a way that it wasn't before. And I think Tate Modern has got something to do with it, but contemporary art isn't something that you have to feel embarrassed about admitting to being interested in or being if you're a contemporary artist. Now it seems to be a force to be reckoned with culturally.
Absolutely. It has become the culture of choice, actually. It is slightly embarrassing if you go out to say you've been to the theatre. Some people feel, unless it's something very fashionable like the Vagina Monologues, you know, or the RSC history plays, theatre has not become a must-see, a must-do. And art has really taken that position. I mean, the opening tickets for the opening of Tate Modern were exchanging hands on the black market, and they were free. What does that tell us? What does that say? People have got to go to the Serpentine. They have to go to the Whitechapel Centenary. They have to go be interested in, you know, Oxford MoMA, the Baltic, the new Fact Centre in Liverpool. These things are really important. Companies all over the square mile are putting money into visual art. They may be very interested in visual art. That may be true, but also I think it's because it's fashionable. People like going to drinks parties at Tate Modern. It's hip. It's a sort of must-do. And it's very interesting that the sort of people who you would have always thought would be interested in Tate Modern are, you know, the sort of liberal chattering classes, but also other people, you know, people who aren't always deemed to have a kind of constituency in the art place are going there. And actually, Nick Sirota and the whole Tate team have been very clever and wise, I think, and proper, since it is a publicly funded building, to encourage that sort of constituency, to put on shows which are broad-based and will include people rather than being overly academic. And I think people have criticised Tate Modern for being like that, but I think it's a huge accolade to Lars Nitwer, to Nick Sirota and the rest of them, that Tate Modern is really for everyone.
I mean, do you think that this whole resurgence of confidence in British art, I believe Nick Sirota has always had this confidence and belief, but it seems to be something that is so specific and so discernible now in terms of Britain, and as you say, it's a constituency that goes outside of the art world. And if you go to Tate Modern, the queues, the people, the numbers of people coming up from everywhere to see it, and to be challenged too, I mean, it's not that they're putting on shows that aren't challenging, is a very significant manifestation in British culture.
It's hugely significant. I think we are in the middle of a massive cultural revolution. I mean, Young's Beer has actually used an advert which is a direct rip-off from a Damien Hirst. They've got a man in a tank with a sheep looking on. Now, this is for bitter. If you just sit down and think about this, Young's marketing department, and I know this because I've interviewed the head of marketing about this very issue, acknowledges that their bitter drinkers will A, know who Damien Hirst is, B, get the joke, C, and crucially, aspire to being like the sort of person who would know what a Damien Hirst is. So it's not like they're looking at kind of, oh, lovies, oh, you art so-and-sos, we hate you. It's like, oh, art is groovy, we want to be part of the party. That is an extraordinary vault face. If you actually realise that, you know, the tabloid press were deeply antagonistic to art, 10 years ago they felt threatened by it, they were, you know, angry about state subsidy going to it. Now Tate Modern is used by people from the city to the government to any number of social groupings as a signal of huge success and of Britain being groovy and modern and kind of with it. And I think, and the other interesting thing I'd like to add to this is it's not just the sort of Damien Hirst generation. There is a whole load of other interesting artists who, you know, perhaps the way has been paved for them by the YBAs, but the YBAs have handed, the baton to a whole, to use a very boring cliche, to a whole bunch of other artists who might not have anything to do with that Goldsmiths alumni, but who have just got the excitement and who have carried on the verve that have really excited the public and made something like the Turner Prize a truly public event.
Very finally, let's come back to the Biennale, because, as I said, you said to me yesterday, it's the first one you've been to. It's unlike any other exhibition, let alone an international exhibition. So, I mean, do you get a sense of the thing as a whole and its value, its importance, its reason for existing?
Well, I just thought, you know, it was a really huge crowd today looking at all the pavilions, a very young crowd, which was good. And the pavilions were extraordinary in their range. And I just think that, you know, I love the kind of open airness of it, the fact that you can just kind of wander from place to place. There's no expectation on you to sort of form an instant opinion. All these things are up for offer, and they're the best, or they're some of the best that each country can offer. And then you can just jump on a boat and go to the Giudecca and see something else. And suddenly you start looking at everything as a work of art. And frankly, Venice is a work of art, so it's a perfect place to have it. And also, the great thing is that it's small enough to have, you know, it's like a convention. It's like a kind of dentist's convention, although, like, you know, 1,000 times more interesting.
But it's an international stage, and not only the countries in the Giardini who have the official pavilions, but more and more countries want to be here and are being here, like Jamaica, like Singapore, like Hong Kong, Baltic here, where we are. It's just a space, a context where people want to be.
I think it just shows that people have realised that art is of hugely importance in a kind of international currency, in international standing, in kind of sexiness, if you like, in fashion, in how fashionable a country is. Art has got to be one of the best ways of articulating that. And it's really, it's kind of amazing that people have really cottoned onto this. They're not showing out their trade fair. They're not showing their GDP. They're showing their artists. And that has got to be, well, it's an interesting thing.
So the 2001 Venice Biennale, what memory will you go away with?
I will probably go away with memory of incredibly sore feet. I have walked miles and I am wearing 4-inch high suede shoes, which was a huge mistake. And I've like fallen off boats and, well, I haven't actually fallen off a boat, but I've fallen sort of through the cracks in a boat and my feet are completely sore and I'm hobbling everywhere. So that's going to be my main memory of the Biennale. Also getting into some party in the Palazzo last night, which was just so overblown and kind of completely over the top and wonderful with sort of, you know, Venice is just so exciting and filmic and ravishing.
Any particular piece of work or pavilion?
I think what I really will go away with in terms of work is Mark Wallinger's piece in the International Arrivals Hall at City Airport, which is set to Allegri's Miserere, and it has the doors opening and people coming out in slow motion. And for an international work, it's an International Arrivals Hall at the festival, at the Biennale, and it couldn't be more totally human in its spirit and in its message. And I defy anyone to watch it without being thoroughly moved and overwhelmed.
With Siobhan Hapaska. Her installation in this very, very beautiful Scuola building consists of a downward hanging forest of Christmas trees, some fresh green, some seared and dead, hanging down within the central square of what is a rectangular chapel in the middle of this deconsecrated space is a smaller rectangle held by four columns, one at each corner. Between the four columns on the floor are the dead needles. At the altar, beneath an altarpiece, is a video playing. These two parts of the installation belong together. There's a terrific smell of the resin of the trees. I'm going to talk to Siobhan Hapaska, one of two Irish representatives at the Biennale this year, about her piece. I want, if possible, just to talk through it in terms of the way in which the various components fit together.
Sure.
So perhaps I could ask you to begin to talk a little bit about the video itself and the way you feel that relates to the altarpiece above it.
Well, when I was first invited to do this show, we did an initial visit out in November, and I knew it was an old Franciscan friary, but I didn't realise that it would have, you know, an altar still in place. And I was actually given the choice at the time to have both the relics removed at each side of the altar. There are two sort of cases with the fragments of a saint's bones, maybe the femur or something. Above the altar, there's a painting of the Madonna with two Franciscans praying at either side of her, and there are three heretics in flames underneath. And I was given the option to have all this stuff removed, but having removed it, it didn't actually really take the identity away that much of the space, so I thought, well, I might as well keep them and work with it. And it also became very clear to me that what I couldn't do is just transport sculptures, working in the same sort of vein that I had been before, to a space like this, because it's the most extreme space I think I've ever shown in terms of its identity. So it was quite important to make something that would, you know, say something about the former usage of this space. But in any case, I decided for the first time to make a film because I wanted to tell a story about two people, and a film seemed the best way to do that. And I also chose to show this film on a 50-inch plasma screen that fits perfectly into the space that the tabernacle would have normally sat upon. So that's quite an important sort of political gesture for me as well. And the film is called May Day. May Day actually comes from the French M'AIDEZ, and it just translates as help me. And whether you're in a consecrated space or not, I really don't think that religion plays that big a part in anyone's life anymore, but we still have a desperate need to feel that in times of trouble that there is something out there that can help us. Maybe that comes with people practicing yoga or, you know, endless shopping or whatever. But in the film, the couple, they seem to have absolutely everything. They have fantastic clothes, they have a beautiful home. It's all sort of, it's modernist. They're intellectually and aesthetically completely intact. But there's still something missing. And what has gone wrong? Is a language problem, and it's not a simplistic inability to communicate with each other or with any other souls they meet. It's basically a fundamental inability to understand what the hell, you know, what is the point of actually being here. I don't think you would get the impression that these people believe in God in the film, that's not apparent, but they're desperately looking for some external help of some kind or another. They decide to do an act which is at first very bizarre, but in the end it makes sense. Basically, they give each other these two gifts, which the viewer is not aware of the function, and they leave their home and they go to a forest where they have a woodman cut down two tree logs for them. And the tree logs are then placed in their car and it's taken to a beach, and the tree logs are placed parallel with each other. And the couple undress down to these black thermals and they lie down on the logs, and the function of the gift then becomes apparent because it's basically a flashing beacon. And while it may seem fetishistic that they place this flashing beacon between their buttocks, it's not meant to be. It's basically, they can't lie on their back because if you lie on your back, you look upwards, and it's a more, it's sort of a more vulnerable position to be in. But if they lie on their front, they're a bit more protected. And if you're lying on your front with your hands on your head, there's nothing else to hold these objects with other than between your buttocks. It's just a practical solution, really. And basically, the couple are lying there on this deserted beach with these flashing beacons between their buttocks because they're hoping that if there is any notion of a god, or if a higher intelligence, or if anything at all out there, that maybe it will see them and come to them and help them make some sort of sense of what's gone wrong, because they certainly can't find any solutions anymore for themselves.
I had a slightly different reading of the end of that video. I think the video is very, very affecting. And it's in some ways, I think, rather comic.
Right.
There's a kind of ridiculousness about aspects of it.
Sure.
And also that one notices that there are these kind of mythic figures, the woodman,
yeah,
and so on. One also,
yeah,
notices that they are pine logs and,
sure,
therefore,
yeah,
they relate to these upturned,
yeah,
Christmas trees.
But in the sense, the logs, they're really a bit of a sort of a decoy, in a sense. There's no reason why the couple couldn't have gone from the home to the beach and just lay there, but the logs become like a means of delaying the final act because they need a bit more time to sort of think about it. And we do this a lot,
mm-hmm,
in everyday life. You know, we're always throwing decoys into our situations to delay the inevitable or whatever. You know, basically the beacons that they're holding between their buttocks, there's a slight play on Bataille's solar anus as,
yes,
well. Before we could stand upright, supposedly, when we walked around on our, you know, fours, by nature of the fact that our arms are shorter than our legs, it meant that the backside sort of protruded up,
exactly,
and became one of the most expressive parts of the body that we had. So it's a sort of play on that, and it's also referring back to the fact that there's this sort of Madonna looking down on these two souls, and they're totally helpless.
Yes.
And there's absolutely nothing she can do, or two Franciscans, or whatever anyone can do. The basic sort of salvation, if there's any notion of that, comes from the ability of a person to take control of their own situation and sort it out. It's always been like that for myself. I've never found any external help, and I think that people should train themselves to help themselves.
We're here in this very charged space, you know, historically charged space. Some would say spiritually charged space. It's been here for a very long time, and, you know, it's been a place of worship and of prayer and so on. I'd like to ask you a question about what you see, in a way, as the function of a piece like this, and the way in which that might relate to the function of art itself.
I mean, I think people have an undying necessity to get things right. I mean, people by nature, I think, want to do the right thing. And they have, you know, a multitude of ways of expressing themselves and thinking about things. But somehow, people are always slightly uncertain, and we need ways to channel, you know, thoughts. And I think religion sort of really, in a sense, taught people how to think rather than think for themselves. But I really hope that the function of art is to empower people, to give them sort of little enough snippets of information to put everything together and work out a master plan for the individual. It's not a sort of dogma or anything like that. So, I mean, it's by nature of its open-endedness, it just allows a greater degree of space for people to formulate their own ideas as opposed to being told what to think. And people do need assistance, and I think art can sometimes just be a recreational thing, or it can be something that allows you to have an opening after and to meet people and whatever. But I think essentially, when it works really well, it's something that guides people.
So although it doesn't take, as it were, it doesn't fill the spiritual vacuum, what it might do is actually help people in this kind of decentered world to think things through for themselves, even at the level.
I think people have to eventually center themselves, you know, and we center ourselves in all different ways. There is no correct way to do it. And I think anything which allows someone to focus on that is you know, it has to exist, so...
I'm here with Grace Weir with her work, her video piece, Around Now. And Grace, this is based on very much a perspective.
Yes.
Which you've been dealing with for some time with your work, but here we've got this really extraordinary installation with the two screens facing each other, and we're in the vantage point of the clouds. Can we just start by talking about your ideas behind the work and also how it relates to theories of placement and perspective, going back to quite ancient theories, actually.
Yes, well essentially what I did here was I actually filmed right around a cloud. I went up into the sky and basically filmed a perfect circle right around a cloud, looking at the cloud. And then I also, at the same time, filmed the other view, the view out into the surrounding skyscape. So what you're looking at here is we're in between the two views. So one view looks towards the cloud and the other view looks out into the surrounding sky. This piece kind of came about, it probably originated from a quote I read about Euclid. Euclid, in the 12th century, declared it to be an impossible task for a sphere to be unrolled upon a surface. It was very significant at the time. Subsequently, as the Renaissance developed, various theorems of his were actually written out of local constitution because they actually proved linear perspective to be complete falsehood. And at the time, of course, they thought linear perspective was a really accurate representation of reality, and really what linear perspective is just a kind of serviceable way of constructing two-dimensional images. But people thought they were depicting reality. And if you look at the perspective of antiquity, which is based on angles as opposed to straight lines, they basically judge different heights or distances from the angle of the point of view and the angle relating back to the circle. And linear perspective did everything by, you know, length and distance and height, which basically, if you like, considers the world to be constructed of straight lines. And of course, the world is not as spherical as is the back of our eye and all that kind of thing. So I just loved Euclid's quote that it's impossible for a sphere to be unrolled upon a surface. Actually, what kicked it off was working with QuickTime VR technology. QuickTime VR technology maps images around the inside of a cylinder. And the image actually changes as you look at it, as it moves out to the edge of the cylinder. And I was very excited. It was the first kind of new media thing I saw that excited me, because I actually thought that's a huge step forward in representation, because the image is actually reshaping as it maps itself onto the inside of a cylinder. I made some quick jump yaws. I made a small one of a cloud, but then I actually became more interested in actually doing an actual cloud and doing the two points of view, the two as the view looking at the cloud and the view out into the surrounding sky. At the same time as I was reading a lot about Euclid and development of perspective, I also was reading a lot of Deleuze and Guattari, the two French theorists you're probably well aware of, and they talked about this notion of the middle, which fascinated me. I was doing my master's, and then we were getting a lot of lectures on literature and the structure
that was
of stories.
Wasn't
no,
it?
No, that was in Trinity College in
Trinity
Dublin.
College.
The person was teaching us was talking about closure, the importance of closure, and how do you call an end to a story that's an interactive multimedia story? How does one, how what kind of structures new media is bringing about? And I really thought closure is not important at all. I wasn't interested in closure at all. I actually thought this notion of the middle is where things sort of have a certain activity, and I think the middle should be, as opposed to the beginning or the end of a story, the middle of the story is actually where things occur. And so I see this space here, the space between these two walls, as being this middle space, where it's not important whether you're looking at this way, A or B, or whatever you like. It's this kind of middle space we occupy as a viewer, which kind of brings in the notion of the gallery. So really what I wanted to do here is the act. It's the act of travelling in a perfect circle around a cloud. It was the act, the actual event. I was trying to somehow unfold this event. If one was to circle a cloud, how would one construct that, or how would that be? Do you know what I mean? So that was...
Can I just ask with the sound?
Yes.
Is that recorded simultaneously as well with the work, or did you...
No, we had to
do it separately.
We had to do it separately, because this is the sound you hear in a helicopter, but you also have the helicopter blades whirring away. And
that's what I thought.
I didn't want the mechanics.
Yes.
You can hear it. I mean, you can hear this wind up amongst the chopper deca noises. So basically what I did was I had to retake a sound, and add it in afterwards, because there's no way to film without taking in the helicopter. And really I wanted that suspension.
The sound is wonderful. I mean, how did you actually physically get this
sound? It's a high polar wind. It's the studios who actually record sounds. And I went to them and said I wanted a really high polar wind, and they actually mixed two winds they had for me.
You mentioned Brunelleschi as well
in your work.
And I just wanted to talk about that.
Well, what I loved about what I read about Brunelleschi was that he, in that famous experiment he did, the Baptistery doors in Florence, when he constructed his little peephole apparatus, was that he actually didn't depict the sky. He painted silver leaf over the building so that it would reflect the sky, because... which showed the utter false... At the same time as he was proving his linear perspective to be a depiction of reality, it showed that the notion of depicting reality is a complete fiction, really, that he couldn't do the clouds. Clouds are not knowable, by perspective. I mean, it's ridiculous, the idea of mapping clouds, because they change, they dissipate, they're constantly changing. As we travel around this cloud here, it utterly changes. So I just love the idea that he didn't paint the clouds in. And the other piece is actually distance AB, which is like a footnote to this work. It's like, I feel like I've made a very simple
statement. And also positioned in the middle of the work as you look from the back of the space towards the work.
To me, it's like as though I made a sort of a simple statement here, and then it's this kind of long, elaborate footnote. You know what I mean? It's a direct...
It's Einstein, isn't it?
Yes, Einstein. It's basically the narration of it. It's in the second chapter of Relativity when he actually talks about how to define distance. Because Einstein, before he gets into discussing relativity, has to define terms like space and time, etc. In fact, actually, in his preface to his book, he writes, "I leave matters of style to the tailor." And he is quite bold, but he's incredibly imaginative, and I loved his example. The example that he actually gives in his book of defining distance is, he says, suppose a cloud is hovering over Potsdamer Platz, and we erect a pole up to it. He says the height of the pole, coupled with the position of the pole, tells exactly how high the cloud is up there. And I just thought, to define distance AB by a cloud hovering over a square, and that we should go around erecting poles up to them in order to know how high up they are. So I did this kind of whimsical video based on that.
But also Potsdamer Platz being such an interesting concept
now. That's right. In fact, when I went there, it was absolutely, utterly a building site. And there's all this activity, and I thought, we're always defining space, and we're always defining our time in space. And this massive construction going on, and these skyscrapers, going up to the sky. So I wanted to couple documenting that with this whimsical thing of a guy lying on his back erecting a pole up to the sky. It's because it appears, from his point of view, as touching the cloud, it's a play of cinema. The cinema allows a certain play of reality, which, of course, his point of view, you see it as though he's actually touching the cloud. so it's a whimsical take.
Lying on his back.
Yes, absolutely, lying on his back, holding a stick up there. And I wanted to put these pieces together because it's this notion of measurement, defining by measurement, and to get it away from a linear structure.
So now I've just looked at the Irish Pavilion, and I'm talking to Joseph Small. Joseph, could you explain your role in the scheme of things here?
Well, as Irish ambassador to Italy, based in Rome, I have come to Venice specially in connection with the Biennale, and specifically to host a luncheon in honor of the Irish representatives. I was glad to do that. I do it every time, and very, very pleased with the what Grace and Siobhan have produced to represent Ireland at this great cultural event. So I hope that the location, the new location, will prove extremely attractive. Certainly there is more space, and it gives the artists a better opportunity of displaying their works. I hope that the pavilion, the Irish pavilion, attracts a lot of people. I think what they have produced deserves to be seen, and I wish them all the best when it comes to adjudication.
From a British perspective, contemporary visual arts seems to be making a very significant intervention within culture in the way that it didn't in the past. It sort of moved from the back pages to the front pages. And I just wondered about contemporary visual arts in Ireland. I mean, how do you see their position, their intervention at the moment?
Well, I would like to think that there is similar development in Ireland. Certainly, this event, which occurs every 2 years, of course, attracts the support of the Cultural Relations Committee of the Department of Foreign Affairs of Ireland, which is my own home department, and also the Arts Council of Ireland. And I think there's growing recognition of the importance of the visual arts. And I think, in general, there is an advance, there's more progress, and I think that's the trend for the future. So we're looking forward to a very successful Irish presence in 2001 here in Venice at the Biennale.
I'm now in Over Ancona, which is the Turkey Pavilion for this year's Biennale, and I'm talking to Ahmet Oktem. Ahmet, we're standing in the first space that you come into here in Over Ancona, and you have a whole series of small projectors that are projecting a sort of a bluish image of facial images which have a sense of a historical collection, an archival collection. Can you tell me about the source of these images?
These images have stayed in Turkey for a long time. First of all, just I'm interested to foreigners who want to leave or who don't want to leave, but they stay in Turkey, any other places. Who lives in Turkey, and I want to use these identities, different types, you know. Some of them is the archaeologist or philosopher, some of the quite normal persons, any ordinary people, some of them. This is the important thing, you know, of people who want to live to any other places. That I'll try to, as an artist, you know, what can I present it? The problem is I'm not a sociologist or anthropologist, that I'll try to have, can I present in the gallery? That I used to negative photographs. That's a kind of portrait gallery, and then I used to projection, and I used some deformation for scenes, And the blue color is came my past work, because for a long time I'm interested to archives, and I used the blue inks. Blue inks, it's not a, that I say this is not a color, because the blue inks is a, the ink is blue. And then I used to, you know, the blue colors, it's connected with my old works. And this is a kind of ideology, this is in my work, you know. I used to some persons, and I present to, in my work, which is way, you know. I'll try to bring it my way, and I carry, and I make a new portrait gallery, you know, and I try to how it is different. It must be different. I'm not a, like a sociologist or any other person. Mm-hmm. I'll try to, how can I, as an artist, and how can I present it like this?
You use the term portrait gallery, and it has an undisclosed sense of, as I was saying earlier, of a collection, almost a collection of family photographs. They're the sort of photographs that we all have of our relatives and our ancestors and grandparents. But the actual specific images, are they... is it important, the actual images you've chosen, do they depict important people?
First of all, when I start this work, first of all, I think the family photographs. But I couldn't find to document. You know, it's a really big problem. And then a little bit changed to portrait. But, you know, and I couldn't find these photographs to very difficult.
But where did these come from, Ahmed? What is the source of these? Are they relatives of yours?
No, this is the Italian person who has the owner in the big building in Istanbul. And some German archaeologist and some professor, they stayed for a while in Turkey after the wars. And some people came from the Russian, like this, I think. They changed their surname like this. And some of them, the German, especially, I found a lot of document in German library in Turkey, in Istanbul. I'll try to any other person, you know, who came to other countries, and I want to mix, and I mix and all together into this kind of a kind of portrait gallery.
By making the selections you've made and by presenting them in the way you have in this space, they take on a sort of monumentality.
Yeah.
As though each person is being memorialized, but the reason why isn't being disclosed. So there is a very strange tension there, because you assume they are important, but in fact you don't know why.
You know, the photographs, how can it see, is a little bit important, but that I'm saying, you know, I have no lots of chance, you know, I choose these photographs, you know, maybe they are in German library, there is maybe 15 photographs that I choose one of them, then I choose five or six of them, and then I found any other photographs, books or any other persons, and I took to I took these photographs, who lives in the Italian consulate, the person like this. Some photographs, it seems to be monumental. Now, maybe I like this kind of for effectiveness, you know, when I'm thinking to how I present the gallery, I'm thinking the effectiveness. And maybe it's interested this.
It's a very beautiful installation, actually. And the color is a negative. It's a blueprint.
Yeah.
which is also connected with the idea of blue as an indelible colour.
You know, why I am used to blue ink before archive, in Turkey, if you want to cover any or cancel it, anything, you can paint it with blue, official. This is
blue
the, not blue pencil, this is the ink, official stamp ink. They painted with ink, blue ink, and it's covered or canceled to photos or old document. It means, you know, cancel or covered means.
It's a color that's used by official bodies to remove things, remove people, remove text. There's a saying in England about putting the blue pencil through a letter or through a text, which means to, eradicate it, to dissolve it. And I think the people that you have here, they sort of hover between existing and not existing, because they're negatives. Mm-hmm. So there's a sort of interesting political issue that the work raises about people that are lost, mm-hmm. people that disappear maybe. Mm-hmm. By the state.
This is the different, the sociological attitudes or meaning. Just I'm thinking, and in my country, you know, the meaning of this color or officially like this, a little bit, you know, it's the, they use, you know, and the passport or anything, you know, used to stamp the blue. Stamp means it's cancelled, it's finished, or and like this in meaning, you know, that I choose two blue colours like this.
So now I'm talking to Sermin Sheriff. Sermin, we're in one of the galleries here in Nova Ikona, and you have a large panel piece that goes right across from wall to wall, with 50 images of your face with a red scarf covering you up to different extents, and the immediate reading seems to suggest to me issues to do with the female image, to do with cultural ideas about exposure of the female face. But perhaps you could talk a little bit about this piece.
Yes, this is a performance project that I prepared in Istanbul for Venice Biennale. And it's different images with just one scarf. And I choose the red color for its many meanings. For me, it's red representing blood, life, sexuality. And I use scarf as a metaphor, just to outside appearance and how we identify ourselves and the others also. So some of the images are very realistic, some are not. So I played a little bit with the scarf here and showing that with one face it's possible to give different images, different outside appearance, but behind the person is the same. And I like to open up the issues that we all have, how we decide for each other, how we identify each other from outside, like age, being old, young, different skin color. And this is the idea.
Is there also a reference to religious fundamentalism, where the woman's face is often covered completely, apart from a little slit for the eyes?
Well, I didn't think of it specially, because scarf used in many countries, in many places, by women. So it was just because it was performance. While I was doing the shooting, I wasn't thinking of any religious idea, but some of them maybe came like religious representation, but it wasn't my intention to do it.
I'm Vittoria Albani,
Vittorio, I want to question you first about... You seem to be doing so much in this Biennale, and I've got slightly confused now because you have curated a show of video work. You also have an interest in the Turkish Pavilion, and also you are here now with the Mike Nelson. So I just wanted to talk to you about what you've been doing here, your kind of interventions in Venice.
Yes, we like to deal with people, and so we very often, this program that you kindly described, and there are a few lesser other things, and also the long tradition of contributing to the local work to establish the Irish Pavilion this year as well, come from what reality offers to us, suggestions, proposals, people asking advice. So this seems very sort of strangely not thought after, sort of I just pick up what happens. But in a way it is the fact that we are looking to what is happening around. So this is what in the best people can tell about our program that is fresh. The project started, to be honest, like a private commercial gallery, and not by choice, but by bureaucracy, I must say, because wanting to deal with artists, at the beginning I had to ask in the offices which kind of permission I need. So you have to go to the trade chamber, you must undergo examination, put some stamps on forms, go through commissions and so on, and you end in doing something that is different but what you dreamt of. You simply wanted to allow artists to do something, and you end opening what is supposed to be a shop. At the beginning I was disturbed by this, and I said to my friend, it is like if I wanted to offer you a cake made with my hands, and the power pretends I am going to open a bakery, no? You know? So it's disproportionate. But we did it because we are really persistent, and this is the good side of our engagement.
Now, you actually don't work as an artist or curator yourself. I mean, you're actually a doctor.
Yeah.
And your interest in doing all this, did this come out of just a passion of liking art, I mean, or a frustration with the system here? Or
no, frustration with the system is truly a great thing. I am very often sad and upset how much we could do if we were able to network. And in Italy there is a lot of individualism in the art sector. Maybe everybody feels like that in his own country, but I feel it strongly, a sense of loneliness in working in Italy in this sector. You asked before how I choose artists and why being a doctor as my first profession, I deal with art. This is a question that I could simply ask answer because I am a human being, and so art could be meaningful for all of us. If I would be a butcher, maybe I would like the same. And so maybe the good thing in my approach is just because I am not professional in the art world, has been not forced to study when Giotto was born, or Turner, or whatever. And so just enjoy the thing. So it's a very superficial, but also very deep feeling. In the sense that pleasure can be superficial, in the sense you don't study sex, but when you have sex, you enjoy it completely, more or less, obviously, depend on the case. What I mean is the sensation of visual art are independent from words, independent partially from ideas, and this is a thing that attracts me very much, the power of the language of images, of seeing, that really struggle in all pages of art magazine, in all pages of art books. My sincere desire is to see an art catalog without even the numbers of the pages, without no art critics daring to give their opinion. And you go through the pages, maybe minding your own business, like when traveling you look to a fashion magazine, or when a child can go through a newspaper he is unable to read, just to cut away, you know, the images he likes, to do collage. This is a freedom of the visual thing, because there are no words. Words are related to culture, ideas, and so on. This is strange, and it's a thing that I think is not deeply thought after.
And also, though, you're willing to take risks as well. I mean, I was just thinking of this as black as coal intervention. Would you like to talk a little bit about that? Because,
si.
I mean, it's an important thing, and yet
thank you.
Risky.
It's been really embarrassing, I say. Because when the Italian artist Antonio Riello asked me, maybe I would like to have your support, and I said, okay, he's an intelligent man and very nice person. This doesn't sound a compliment to an artist, but, you know, there must be good artists that are nasty and good artists that are nice. So you should think to this when you do a choice. I am joking, obviously, but not completely. And so what I mean is Antonio Riello asked me for support. As being a part of other event, totally different, in being a sort of a, himself, come si dice, when you are paint your face as in fashion, what's the word? Help me.
When you paint your face in fashion, black and you make makeup. When you make up your face.
He intended to make up himself like a black person, and follow me like pretending to be a slave, a black slave. So the idea was about being politically incorrect, and so making a joke of so much, sometimes not so honest concern about being kind to poor people of the third countries and black people and so on. This is a cliché thing at the end for many people. And so Antonio wanted to do this, and I said yes. Later he said, I better disappear as an artist, and I will pay a young, true black man, not makeup, like that, to follow you.
Hello, this is me. I'm standing outside the Spanish Pavilion with Ana Laura Elias. And I'd like to ask you maybe just to describe a little bit the pieces that you have in this exhibition.
Yeah, well, it's very easy. Well, I'm very difficult because I don't like to explain my work, but the thing is that when the art curator Estrella de Diego from Spain called me to participate in the Biennale to represent Spain with the other artist Javier Pérez, I thought that the thing that I want to do was changing the architecture of the pavilion, because I don't like it at all. It's very fascist building.
Fascist?
Yeah, fascist. So I thought, well, let's change the architecture of the pavilion, and let's change the transit of the spectator, because I have the perimetral space that is very, very difficult, that space, because the real space is that you have to go from one entrance and you have to take the a line, I mean like a square line. So I put one door from the exit and the other door, and you have to go to my space from the central piece of the other artist.
Right.
So there are free spaces, and they are like independent spaces, but they communicate to each other. And one title is a rain space, the other is pink space, and the other is liquid sky. And it's just architecture, but working with elements like light, music, mirrors, and very simple ones, but at the same level.
Right, so when you come into the pink space, which is directly in front of us, there are three video projections in that space.
Yes.
Yeah, and on them we see you.
Yeah.
Just your head, like a portrait.
Yeah.
The head is kind of turning.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole kind of aesthetic of the piece is sort of like space, retro kind of...
Exactly, because I'm speaking about the space, but without with my face, because I use my face like a tool. So it's like, it's the floating space. I sing a sound that is, I'm floating, nothing is straight. So there is no gravity. And he said, you see my face, but like a face that is a drawing in a space. It's very simple. I only work with very, very simple concepts.
What's quite interesting is it's kind of retro aesthetic about the future.
Well, yes, because my work speaks about that, but my idea of the future is I used to work about future, but using like something from the past, because I don't believe in future, I don't believe in the past either. You have to construct the time that you live all the time.
Your hairstyle is kind of 1920s maybe, and the style of hat that you wear has this 1920s, but again, completely like future, maybe video game style.
Exactly, exactly, because like I told you before, I like to play with my face like another tool, and a tool that is like, you see eyes, a mouth and a nose, and it's like something that is moving and it's changing all the time. It's a kind of level of beauty. Sometimes I feel so beautiful because I feel something in my inside, and something I feel like an ugly person, but I only use myself when I feel beautiful.
So that's the pink space, and then the blue space, or the mirror space, you have with water coming down, and you come into a first area which has a large disc mirror in which you see yourself coming into the space full size, and then a long strip of just one thin stream of water coming down. What's the kind of idea behind that?
There is no meaning, actually. It's just something. When you go to my spaces, the only thing that I want is like, they are not a trump.
A trick.
Yeah. It's an hypnotic space.
Right.
It's something that you feel very comfortable. Mm. And it's like a flash, because there are not too many things, but it's something very comfortable, aesthetically speaking.
The sound is obviously very important.
It's very important because I do the music myself. It's my voice.
Yeah, it's really the foundation of the work, possibly, because that really creates
exactly, the ambience. Exactly, exactly. Some of the pieces that I did here, I thought first in the music, and I thought, wow, I imagine an architecture from this piece of music, because the music is very architectural for me, because when I hear something that I like it, I imagine how can I live in that mental space. It's an abstract concept of the space.
And how do you feel about being at the Biennale in general? What do you feel about the Biennale?
I don't like the social part, because the people ask me about, oh, you must feel like you can get a recognition or something like that, and I don't like that, because I don't like this kind of things. I don't believe in success, because I don't believe in failure either. But the good thing is that the people can see my work, and I'm Spanish, and we have a terrible situation. I mean, I could be rich if I were from England, for example, but I'm Spanish, so I don't have the same situation. So this is a good opportunity for me.
For an international platform,
platform, that's the point.
There has been, for example, quite a bit of political discussion. I mean, some people have quite strong opinions about this. What is your opinion?
I think it's very good that there are art events, because some of the people think that the art is dead or something like that. And I don't believe in this kind of generalization. So I think you can pick up beautiful things from the event. So it's a good information for the good and for the bad. I think we need to have more art health situations. Maybe not only the biennials, but the biennials are good. So it's like trying to get new spaces and new situations for the new art.
Hello, this is me.